name to put on the door. He had scrawled it in his notes. The Office of Plant Introduction. While Fairchild spoke, Secretary Wilson leaned back with an expression that betrayed he was impressed. His spectacles twirled between his fingers. He emptied his mouth into a spittoon. Fairchild had come prepared. He also had good timing. The year 1898 was only half over, but it had already proved consequential, a year that revealed substantial stress on America's agricultural economy. Wilson's boss, President McKinley, had narrowly won election 2 years prior over William Jennings Bryan, whose populist campaign had riled farmers, especially ones who felt squeezed by advances in mechanization that they couldn't afford. McKinley was lucky, especially considering that Bryan's support had actually started as far back as the 1880s when farmers began to assemble into a group called the Farmers' Alliance. The group became fervent enough by the early 1890s to launch its own political party, the Populists, which, led by Bryan in 1896, came within 600,000 votes of winning the presidency. If McKinley wanted to keep his job, he'd have to address farmers' angst. Not with tired old ideas, but with inventive new ones. Wilson spat in the spittoon again. He called for a man outside the office, who came in a moment later. Wilson recounted the outlines of the idea. The man, the department's dispersing officer, thought for a moment, then admitted that, yes, if the secretary wanted it, money could be procured. Wilson looked back at Fairchild. He'd be an employee again at the department, giving him the credibility of government backing. All Wilson wanted, however, were two changes to the plan. One was to expand the plant collecting team from a triad of young men to include anyone currently abroad on government business. They would be encouraged to contribute seeds, and provided they be sensible, their expenses would be paid. Wilson believed this would widen the reach of the new section from a handful of hunters to potentially dozens. The other change became apparent 2 days later. Wilson summoned Fairchild to tell him he had found office space. Fairchild and the secretary marched up 4 flights to where the rafters nearly touched their heads. Wilson pointed to a small nameplate on the wall. The Office of Plant Introduction had become the Office of Seed and Plant Introduction. The title was obtuse. Seeds were part of plants. But Fairchild knew seeds were the currency of Congress, and if it helped convince Wilson and the department's bean counters, Fairchild could look past the redundancy. Wilson had also procured an old carriage house for Fairchild to store plant material in, a pitiful greenhouse, but it would have to work. He walked outside with Fairchild to see it. "Don't let them crowd you out, my boy," he said. The secretary stood for a moment, then turned and disappeared back inside. Seeds began to pour in immediately. Durum wheats from Russia, grapes, mushrooms, and pomegranates from Europe. Fairchild's initial ambition to start a plant introduction program was replaced by the urgency to find a place to put them all. The greenhouse, overflowing with papers and boxes from other sections, wasn't big enough. Fairchild spent his days shuttling seeds to and from the greenhouse and returning in the heat of the afternoon to his desk to write. The majority of the job wasn't botany, but correspondence. Explorers needed assignments. Experimenters wanted samples. Farmers were desperate for seeds. To investigate how to expand the reach of the section, Fairchild decided to take a trip. Hawaii was too far, and his recent failure too fresh. So the only remaining place suitable for tropical botany was Florida, an area of remarkable heat and humidity, and hardly any people. In 1898, there were just 1,600 people who lived on either side of the Miami River, which bisected the town of Miami like a pageant sash. No one prized Florida for its potential, least of all farmers. Salt-blasted land couldn't support wheat or corn. This Fairchild knew. He was also aware that Florida's last experiment with food introduction had ended in spectacular failure. In 1829, Henry Perrine, United States consul in Campeche, Mexico, was one of the few men to answer Washington's request for useful plants. He became so interested in America's botany that he left his post to start an experimentation garden in South Florida. Perrine asked Congress for land in the region, but was denied due to hostility from the Seminole Indians. When he insisted that it was Florida or nowhere, Congress granted Perrine 36 square miles at the southern end of the peninsula. Cautious of the Indians, he moved his wife and three kids to Indian Key, a small island accessible only by boat. The water, however, couldn't protect him. In August of 1840, a group of Seminoles raided Indian Key with torches and arrows. Perrine helped his family escape by boat to be rescued by the Navy, and then he went back to battle with the Seminoles. Eventually, his limp body was discovered, charred by fire. After Congress passed a resolution honoring Perrine, the idea of plant experimentation went unmentioned for the next half century. Another reason for Fairchild's visit to Florida was the rumor of a land donation on the south banks of the Miami River, where newly introduced plants might thrive. Florida hardly compared with the East Indies. Its trees were short, and their greens all the same hue. But it was dense enough to be jungle, and more important, it had tropical character. Plants like coconut palms and the occasional mango had already begun arriving, carried by birds, travelers, or soldiers returning from Cuba. Near Miami, Fairchild met Henry Flagler, the wealthy co-founder of Standard Oil, and he was invited to stay at the rich man's new hotel, the Royal Palm, a five-story temple of modern luxury painted in Flagler's characteristic yellow. The resort was the first in Florida to have elevators, and its veranda, a wooden boardwalk almost a fifth of a mile around, circled Miami's first swimming pool. A perfectly circular driveway welcomed visitors in front, and out back, women in long, puffy skirts teed off rounds of golf. Florida had no one bigger than Flagler. In an empty landscape, the millionaire imagined a future of luxury hotels, grand estates, and sculpted gardens that would draw rich Americans. If there was a 19th century disruptor, Flagler was it. After he financed Florida's first railroad, he transformed a sandy dune north of Miami into Palm Beach, the future home of American billionaires. The upstart spirit may have been one reason Fairchild found South Florida so charming. But the region's potential for agriculture delighted him more. "I was thrilled to find tropical territory in the United States, and a love for southern Florida was born in my heart," he would write. And the more he thought about it, the more certain he felt that a flood of migration would one day fill Florida with thousands of people, maybe millions. A land in America with the potential to support coconuts, pineapples, and mangoes would be too irresistible to remain a ghost town. At the time, however, Florida was a bust. Fairchild returned to Washington excited by the idea of starting an experiment garden in Miami, but was told the government didn't have the money to buy land, and Washington couldn't legally accept a donation. The early work of plant introduction came with regular disappointment of this sort. Trying to do something that had never been done before, Fairchild met the institutional roadblocks that would forever hamper government efficiency. But Fairchild's work did become thick and fast, in his judgment. When winter turned to spring that year, two things happened. Nursery stock had begun to sprout, which brought urgency to figure out where these samples could go. The facilities didn't exist to take adequate care of them, and more were sprouting each day. Adding to his frenetic pace was Congress's endorsement of the program, and the insistence that more be done, and faster, to help American crop growers. Congress granted Fairchild's office a new appropriation of $20,000, a sky-high sum for a new section run by a young scientist. Fairchild hired a secretary named Grace, who had a braid down her back and wore skirts that stopped at her knees. A decade his junior, she was the first female Fairchild encountered who was interested in plants. And yet, despite the help, most of the work still fell to Fairchild himself. He worked evenings and Saturdays, frequently Sundays as well. Secretary Wilson made a habit of checking on him when he left for the day, and upon arrival the next morning, chiding him that he ought to find proper housing. Yet with Swingle in Europe investigating table grapes, there was no one close to Fairchild to warn him to slow down. A nervous collapse was a real and dangerous condition brought on by overwork, and Fairchild seemed headed directly for one.
"By God, you look awful," said the man who darkened Fairchild's door one afternoon.
Fairchild, in the middle of writing a letter, looked up to lock eyes with Barbara Lathrop, whose tall build filled the doorframe. Lathrop hadn't gone completely silent after separating from Fairchild in San Francisco. Wondering what Fairchild was doing in Washington, he sent repeated missives, some cogent, some stream of consciousness. The occasional reply from Fairchild pleased Lathrop. Despite the failure of their original plan in Hawaii, the older man was impressed by the ingenuity Fairchild demonstrated in Washington. He had talked his way into a government department and built an office, and somehow he had managed to keep it running. But Lathrop hadn't come with accolades. In fact, after a year on his own, he had again grown hungry for purpose, and, judging by another surprise visit to Fairchild, this, his third, renewed companionship. A blunt man who seemed incapable of giving a compliment, he made no effort to sugarcoat his assessment.
"David," he said, "you're no more fit to build up a government office of plant introduction than I am to run a chicken farm, and I don't know a thing about chickens."
Fairchild leaned back and smiled.
"You have no contacts with the rest of the world. How do you expect to secure your seeds and plants? You can't do that sort of thing by correspondence. If you try to run things from Washington, it will be a little pinchbeck affair."
The expression was new. Pinchbeck was a man who invented a cheap substitute for gold, a knockoff alloy made from copper and zinc. The sentiment, though, was an old one that Fairchild had come to expect. Lathrop believed Fairchild's botanical background was more useful on steamships and in foreign ports than in a poorly ventilated government office. Lathrop resorted to criticism to shroud his longing, even desperation, that the two might travel together again. When he sat down to discuss details, Lathrop vowed that, as before, he would pay every expense, and that they'd visit different ports than on their last odyssey. Two sleepless nights passed while Fairchild considered the proposal. His loyalty to Wilson, owing to the secretary's trust in him, was slowly overtaken by the realization that Lathrop was right. David Fairchild wasn't an office man.
"I do not approve of it at all," were Secretary Wilson's only benign words in a tirade of displeasure.
Wilson accused Fairchild of running away from his responsibilities, and wondered who would take over the program Fairchild had lobbied so hard to create, and that Wilson had expended political capital to support. Wilson didn't say it, but he resented Barbara Lathrop, whom he considered a reckless and irreverent influence on Fairchild. In Fairchild, Wilson may have seen a future secretary, a steady, inventive, and hard-working civil servant, who might rise through the ranks if he kept his head down. To Lathrop, such a fate was worse than being eaten by a walrus. Without arguing face to face, the two men were sparring over Fairchild's future. Would he be a man of methodical bureaucracy, or a capricious adventurer and gentleman? The meeting ended with a grunt. Ultimately, though, Wilson relented. Whether he fired Fairchild may have been a formality, but ties were severed. In exchange for his department receiving the future fruits of Fairchild's efforts abroad, all he offered was a formal letter with a gold USDA seal, which might help cajole stubborn foreign officials. Wilson stipulated that expenses would be paid by Lathrop, and, to procure plant material from foreign countries, he was granted a maximum budget of $1,000. Even though Fairchild told the secretary that he would likely visit South America, India, and the dark continent of Africa, where unknown crops held millions of dollars of promise for America's farmers, and even though Wilson suggested that Fairchild look into cotton production in Peru, the cereal industry in Chile, and orange-growing methods in Paraguay, the Secretary of Agriculture refused to pay Fairchild any salary. When news reached Lathrop later that day, he, without blinking, agreed to cover that, too. Chapter 7. Crossing Countries. Silverware and crystal glasses flitted over a white tablecloth as the luxury train holding Fairchild traveled west from Washington,
first through Chicago, and then through open prairie toward San Francisco. Taking a train west was a rare American journey in the late days of the 1890s, but it was a luxurious one. For every 20 East Coasters who voyaged to Europe, only one went to California. The novelist Charles Nordoff made a grand display of riding a train across the country during the era, documenting every detail. California, he reported, is to us Eastern people still a land of big beets and pumpkins, of rough miners, of pistols, bowie knives, abundant fruit, queer wines, high prices, full of discomforts and abounding in dangers to the peaceful traveler. The rush of 1849 gold seekers had slowed to a trickle by the end of the century, the easiest nuggets presumed discovered. Now, those heading west were pitied by their friends for the deluge of annoyances and dangers awaiting anyone with the audacity to leave the self-centered corridor between Washington and New York. It would be years before Secretary Wilson would admit that Fairchild's decision to leave Washington had been the right one. Fairchild couldn't be caged. His talent exceeded the duties of a bureaucratic seed recipient. Other 29-year-old men might have been content with stable desk jobs, working for the United States government in the capital of the world's rising power, with a typist of their own and an annual salary of $800. Perhaps that would have been enough for a younger Fairchild, too, but his ambition had grown, thanks to the influence and bank account of one man, for whom office work was a fate worse than death. Lathrop, meanwhile, lacked the patience to wait for Fairchild to tidy his affairs in Washington. So Fairchild rode the Central Pacific Railroad across the country alone, passing hundreds of miles of corn, wheat, and oats in fields, all in October of 1898, approaching the beginning of their slow-growing winter. The summer had brought excessive rains to the Great Plains, covering Midwestern corn and wheat with spots of bright yellow rust. The voyage across America, east to west, left little impression on Fairchild, despite the vivid look it offered of the country's transformation. The western frontier neatly embodied the progress of America's past, a nation scrappy and hungry. It also offered a portrait of the country's future. The concept of American superiority was born from revolutionary victory over the British. But as the country's ego grew, so did its energy, first in a second victory over the British in 1812, and then in exterminating the cancer of slavery in 1865. Each success brought bursts of new patriotism, and the frontier offered the best place to put it, effectively America's escape valve of ambition. Europe, by comparison, had run out of land long before, which helped explain its wars and collapsed empires. But America could travel farther and farther west, until, in the 1890s, all the stakes of land had been claimed. If America's future could be foreshadowed, Fairchild would have seen it on the plains. A settled frontier meant no place left to put the excess enthusiasm of a growing country. America would have to expand in new ways, overseas, and in industries it had never before dominated, such as agriculture. Fairchild was now traveling on Lathrop's dime, which meant an upgrade from the nickel plate road menu of sliced tomatoes and baked beans afforded cargo rate travelers. The Transcontinental Railroad connected New York to Sacramento at the new exhilarating speed of 35 miles per hour. Earlier railroad companies judged their success by simply running on time with no additional frills. Seeing the inelegant way passengers brought their own food on board and how they relieved themselves in shanty huts inspired a man named Fred Harvey to start America's first restaurant chain, Harvey House, a series of railroad rest stops where young, unmarried women served quick gourmet meals to accommodate frenetic rail schedules. Eventually, by the beginning of the so-called Golden Age of Travel in 1890, the railroads had mastered onboard food service, which brought the luxury of calm and comfort. Delicacies like mutton chops, veal cutlets, and grouse could be washed down with endless glasses of bubbly French champagne. An enviable menu, however, couldn't mask the endless squeal of steel wheels on steel track. When he arrived on America's foggy west coast, Fairchild, well-fed but fatigued, was met in San Francisco by an irritated Lathrop, who announced before any greeting at all that the ship Fairchild had hurried across the continent to catch the one that would take them to South America, had already left. The next available boat taking passengers south would sail from New Orleans, a 2-week train ride at least. Fairchild and Lathrop boarded a train, heading south, hugging at times the Pacific coast. The train made a stop in Santa Barbara, where Fairchild spent a short layover with Dr. Francesco Franceschi, a long-nosed plant enthusiast who cut for his visitor a slice of a curious squash. Zucchini, he called it, emphasizing the full whimsy of the Italian name. Zucchini was new to Fairchild, and as a result of his tasting it in California, it qualified for plant introduction to farmers around the country. The squash had originated somewhere in Central America, yet its development as a food crop occurred in advanced laboratories in Italy and France. Nature's real intent was for zucchini to be eaten small, before its blossoms fell, its name Italian for little squash. Chefs of the future would ignore this and value zucchini most for its size. Never mind that larger size brought diminished flavor, if any whatsoever. Nor was any botanist present to remind people that the vegetable zucchini, the enlarged ovary of the zucchini plant, was, in fact, a fruit. Fairchild and Lathrop traveled south to Los Angeles, and then, for more than a week, east toward the Gulf of Mexico. A month after he had left Washington for the Pacific coast, Fairchild found himself in Louisiana. Fairchild and Lathrop reached the New Orleans harbor to learn that they had missed the Panama-bound boat by less than an hour. This time, Lathrop was utterly disgusted. He bought tickets for the next train to New York, where he was certain a boat would eventually sail south. After a month spent crisscrossing the country, missing a third boat might have entirely unraveled Lathrop's anxious resolve. For the best, on December 27, 1898, the men embarked from Queens, New York, hugging America's east coast, bound for Jamaica. Ice covered the rigging of ropes and cables, all frozen solid by a cold wind. Each morning a passenger on board made a grand scene to ask the captain for the ship's latitude and longitude, a request with no practical purpose. Such a meaningless gesture annoyed Lathrop, who had long ago bored of the early novelties of travel. Like train travel, ocean voyages in the 1890s had reached the height of glamour. Ships crossing the Atlantic bore names like Mauritania and Majestic, and boasted expensive paintings and first-class libraries, lounges, and wood-paneled dining rooms. Routes servicing the Caribbean were more pedestrian, their ships outfitted more as shuttles than as floating hotels. Even so, on any given boat, Lathrop was always granted the best cabin. Fairchild slept with the masses, often sharing a small room or bunk bed with another passenger. Lathrop had a desk. Fairchild wrote on the floor. Fairchild began to explore the moment he stepped off the boat. Kingston, Jamaica was the first foreign port in which I began a serious study of the marketplaces, he wrote, tasting the new fruits and vegetables, packing and shipping both seeds and cuttings of those which seemed desirable for introduction into the United States. At busy markets, he sampled everything for sale, including small red and yellow tomatoes that grew on a bush so large it resembled a tree. The fruit, he wrote in his pocket notebook, was eaten after peeling off the thick rind with sugar and cream or salt and pepper, or as an apple would be. He also came across a lumpy, reddish fruit called an aki, originally from Africa but brought to the Caribbean on slave ships and adopted quickly as a side dish with fish. It has a fine flavor and is highly esteemed for Puerto Rico and Hawaii, he scrawled. After Fairchild's year as a Washington bureaucrat, his dispatches had acquired a new efficiency. If his first world tour was slowed by imprecision and uncertainty, to his second he brought the confidence of knowing what was worth his time and what wasn't. His attention turned quickly to the brighter colors and sweeter tastes of mangoes, dwarf oranges, even cacao. Fairchild tasted them all, sometimes navigating through crowded markets as Lathrop sauntered behind, taking each sample and giving it a verdict. At this, Lathrop was unusually helpful. "Mr. Lathrop had an extraordinary palate for flavors," Fairchild noticed. "Everything we introduced would have to run a gauntlet of sarcastic criticism when it reached Washington. But when Mr. Lathrop said that a food was good, delicious, in fact, I would be able to tell those who declared the stuff wasn't fit to eat that evidently they had uneducated palates." More exciting than the new tastes was the logistical convenience that anything that grew in Jamaica, an island just over 500 miles from the United States, could reasonably be expected to thrive in Florida. The two were invited to dine with the governor one night, the high watermark of any unannounced visit. And so, the next morning, Lathrop wanted to move on. He rarely missed the opportunity to remind Fairchild that if they wanted to see the world, they couldn't linger any place too long. Fairchild convinced him to stay another few days so he could travel to the outskirts of Kingston, where small farms grew subsistence crops not seen anywhere else on Earth. When he arrived at one farm, the fruit Fairchild observed was strange in shape, bulbous at one end and pointed at the other. Vegetable pears, people called them, a member of the cucumber family with crisp flesh and inoffensive flavor, akin to chomping an apple with a numb tongue. The vegetable pear would later be known in Washington as the chayote. "Mr. Lathrop was enthusiastic about the chayote," Fairchild said. "He liked its taste and its versatility, like squashes, of being served either raw or cooked. Perhaps most compelling, the abundance of the chayote on hundreds of trees suggested they'd be easy to grow." While Fairchild and Lathrop sailed south to Grenada and then to Barbados, a bundle of seed with written instructions made its way to Washington. With every new sample, Fairchild was constantly refining his packing method, alternating between potatoes and wet moss to keep cuttings moist. Swingle had experimented with wet cigarette paper, banana leaves, and sorghum moss. Fairchild tried all of these and asked local people for advice on shipping plants. Most farmers were oblivious. Even botanical expertise couldn't overcome the fact that seeds had to move by boat, stopping at one port after another like a city bus. There was no express service, nor any assurance that the samples would stay alive in transit, if they reached their destination at all. Even so, getting seeds to the United States was the easy part. Convincing Americans to actually grow the fruit and then eat it would be the bigger challenge. And this required volume. The work of food exploration wasn't solely to find crops in their original habitat. No one, not even Fairchild, whose academic knowledge and field experience exceeded that of most people on Earth, could truly expect to find the world's most economically valuable fruits by making short stopovers to small islands. Exploration, and especially food hunting, also required diplomacy. It required finding researchers and enthusiasts around the world who might serve as correspondents, who might contribute seeds and cuttings as gifts to America, or for the thrill of knowing they grow in United States soil. When he met these people, Fairchild would unfurl his introduction on Department of Agriculture letterhead, which identified him as a culinary diplomat. No one's eyes lingered on the title Special Agent. The golden seal was shinier. Surprised at how well it worked, Fairchild began to refer to the sticker, the embossed seal of the Department of Agriculture, as a Dago Dazzler. Next was Trinidad. Fairchild knew that the island was the land of mangoes, at least the most robust ones outside of the Eastern Hemisphere. Though mangoes weren't unknown in the U.S., in Trinidad he found an array of new varieties. At least a dozen grew there, each one slightly different. Fairchild took three, and within weeks the fruit turned up in Washington. His associates at the USDA found the three mangoes to have insurmountable faults. The Gordon mango was large but bland. The Peters No. 1 was sweet but ripened unevenly. And the Père Louis, while perfect in its native habitat, couldn't be reliably grown from seed. All three were discarded. The rhythm of travel was becoming easier. And unlike on their first voyage, Fairchild and Lathrop had a mutual understanding that often required little discussion. The old kinks sometimes emerged, but were less pronounced. Fairchild was happy
wishing he could drag his feet and stay longer. Lathrop was less irritable than usual, preferring only that the two could move a little faster. As Fairchild and Lathrop crossed the small inlets between Caribbean islands, back in the States, the idea of plant introduction was taking hold. One reason that Secretary Wilson had been so bitter to see Fairchild leave the department was that he himself was energized by the idea of foreign plants. The secretary felt that he was leading something historic, at least until Fairchild departed the office and left the effort in flux. Wilson's agricultural report for 1897, which came out in 1898, crowed about the exciting new effort. "A scientist has been appointed in the department to have charge of seed and plant importation," he wrote. "Our country has profited by introducing new seeds and plants, but much of this work has been done in the dark." The message was clear and boastful. Wilson continued, "The old world contains many things that would be valuable to the new world." This was news that needed to be proclaimed publicly. America was a country built on the idea that hard work and ingenuity would yield prosperity. Yet America's farmers were finding just the opposite, and they blamed the government. Newspapers crowed about the newest railroad, the newest oil discovery, and the newest boom on Wall Street. But farming seemed stagnant. "There is something radically wrong in our industrial system," the editorial board of the journal The Progressive Farmer wrote in 1887. "There is a screw loose. The wheels have dropped out of balance. The railroads have never been so prosperous, and yet agriculture languishes. The banks have never done a better or more profitable business, and yet agriculture languishes. Manufacturing enterprises never made more money or were in a more flourishing condition, and yet agriculture languishes. Towns and cities flourish and boom and grow and boom, and yet agriculture languishes. Salaries and fees were never so temptingly high and desirable, and yet agriculture languishes." The frustration that poured into Washington from farmers tended to make clear that they weren't asking for money. Not that they were against a handout, but none were naive enough to think that free money was a lasting solution. What they wanted, instead, was acknowledgement that America's doctrine of expansion and reconstruction completely undercut farming. There was too much land, and on it, everyone growing the same crops. The nation was buried beneath great piles of corn, wheat, and cotton. In 1870, corn sold for 43 cents per bushel. By 1895, it had dropped to 30 cents, and less when sold in larger quantity. A bushel of wheat worth $1.06 in 1870 had lost almost 40% of its value by the time McKinley became president. Things got so bad that when corn became cheaper than coal, Kansas farmers began to burn their crop instead of sell it. In the Dakotas, the cost of harvesting and transporting wheat was more than it could sell for, so it was left in the field to eventually keel over. A few decades earlier, the problem had been easy to solve. If things got bad, farmers could simply travel farther west, where land, opportunity, and start-over stories were still abundant. But by 1898, with land mostly occupied and risk-taking more expensive, farmers were stuck. And being stuck in a business that required new seeds, new labor, and expensive equipment meant constantly digging oneself into a deeper hole of debt. America wasn't the first country to confront these problems. People in China had farmed for thousands of years before the United States first broke free of colonialism. Egypt's farmers had managed land since the dawn of civilization. The difference was that America's goal wasn't just to farm, it was to construct an industrial agriculture system bigger and more profitable than any group of people had ever built. Few farmers could have realized that they were part of this grand experiment in human history. They were too busy being angry at their broken country. The promise that hard work would yield great reward was undercut by the reality that hard work was actually making people poorer. As William McKinley took the presidency, a Wichita farmer named Mary Elizabeth Lease, a woman of 37 years, four children,
and a growing pile of unused corn, was building a reputation for her irreverence toward Washington. "What farmers need to do is raise less corn and more hell," she often said. She flayed politicians and their profligacy in the face of suffering on the plains, at the cost of being ridiculed, dismissed, and reviled by those she assailed. But she didn't care. "The parties lie to us, and the political speakers mislead us," she told audiences across the Midwest. "We were told to go to work and raise a big crop. That was all we needed. We went to work and plowed and planted. The rains fell, the sun shone, nature smiled, and we raised the big crop that they told us to. And what came of it? 8 cent corn, 10 cent oats, 2 cent beef, and no price at all for butter and eggs. That's what came of it." On the morning his ship landed in La Guaira, the largest port in Venezuela, Fairchild touched the continent of South America for the first time. Lathrop, for all of his travels, had only sparsely visited the Latin countries that altogether constituted more than 10% of Earth's land. South America had been geographically inconvenient, isolated by oceans and far from everything, filled with forested swamps, mountains, and native peoples so unknown that Teddy Roosevelt himself, in the days after his presidency a decade later, hiked through the treacherous jungles of the Amazon on a journey so harrowing American newspaper writers openly expected him to die. He didn't, but his later biographers were stunned to learn that the wicked conditions nearly drove him to suicide. Venezuela had several culinary highlights, chiefly apio, a root vegetable that seemed like a mix between a carrot and celery. Another tuber, which appeared similar to a potato and had the taste of artichoke, flavored every type of Venezuelan soup. But in the pages of his journals during his first trip to Venezuela, food and botany would not be the foremost things Fairchild would remember. One morning, after eating breakfast alone, he learned that Lathrop, still in bed, wanted to stay behind. Lathrop had woken feeling off, as though his muscles had slept themselves twisted. When Fairchild returned later that day, Lathrop was nearly dead. His head ached so severely that he fell in and out of consciousness. As he lay in bed moaning, the heat from his skin warmed the room. Somewhere in Barbados, or in the mountains of northern Venezuela, a female mosquito had bitten him and transferred the virus that caused Caracas fever. The rest of the world knew it as yellow fever, yellow because of the jaundice that corrupted red blood cells and lit the skin gold. Fairchild had been at Lathrop's side for more than 2 months. The bite just as easily might have been his. "I was badly frightened, for I was totally inexperienced in medical matters," Fairchild recalled. Unusual for a man of the 19th century, he had hardly confronted death. Once, when he was 9, a neighbor boy got his foot stuck in a wagon wheel. Fairchild overheard the news so quickly, fracture, gangrene, funeral, that the occurrence felt removed. Only one other time had he seen a mammal die, and it was a horse. Lathrop's panting attracted the attention of two other Anglophones staying at the same inn. Fairchild stood and watched as the men repositioned Lathrop. They forced fluids and soup and elevated the patient's head and feet. Fairchild sat vigil for 2 days. That Lathrop did not die quickly was the clearest sign that he would live. And sensing that, Fairchild wondered whether he might still have time for crop collections. Even if Lathrop died, Fairchild thought, the older man would bristle at an expedition squandered. The two Englishmen provided such good care that in less than a week, Lathrop, once near death, could stand on his feet. A few days later, his temper returned, bringing immense relief to Fairchild. Having spent a week longer than planned in Venezuela, the country that nearly took his life, Lathrop was ready to leave immediately. Fairchild helped him hobble from a flimsy wheelchair to a horse cart to a waiting ship. As they traveled west toward the Panama Isthmus, Lathrop's only request was fresh milk. When the boat stopped for provisions at Maracaibo, the final port in Venezuela before moving on to Colombia, Fairchild set off to find some. Cows covered hillsides like patches of carpet, yet no one sold milk. Fairchild found a man willing to deal, provided Fairchild milk the beast himself. The price was exorbitant,
$5 per bottle, or nearly $100 today, but the milk was warm and fresh. The north coast of South America was neither man's favorite, and as a result of such episodes, they never returned there together. As their steamer hugged the coast, the small shanty huts on shore looked like festering pools for yellow fever and malaria. Lathrop's continued convalescence and Fairchild's fear of catching something similar left them both happy to remain on board until a train would take them across Panama to the Pacific. Happy, except when considering their accompanying cargo. As days passed, Fairchild and Lathrop sat on deck with 50 moaning bulls. The ocean breeze, long in its gusts, proved no match for the growing piles of manure, which covered the ship's deck and grew taller each day. Chapter 8. Alligator Pears. The Andes, sharp and protruding, were striking at first sight. But even their peaks, which poked through the clouds, couldn't mask that the mountains presented a large problem. Fairchild spent his days in Lima at markets, polishing seeds of fruits grown nearby and judging which could be suitable for American fields. None were qualified. Crops that thrived 5,000 feet up in the Andes would never grow in America's low-lying plains. Agriculturally, the Andes stood alone, an icy ridge adjacent to a warm ocean, strewn with active volcanoes and geologic faults that could trigger landslides and floods. Other than building mountaintop civilizations like Machu Picchu, the Inca's most notable accomplishment may have been living with the planet's most fickle climate, where temperatures could oscillate 50 degrees in hours. For all of its glamour, food exploration was, as Fairchild was learning, a process not prone to wild success. Finding workable crops demanded educated guesses about growing conditions, but even in favorable environments, the guesses still amounted to gambles. A pinch of seed may come half around the world for a cost of only 5 cents, Fairchild wrote about the tedious process. But growing the seed will probably require a flat in a hothouse, followed in sequence by a bench of 2-inch pots, a greenhouse of 6-inch potted plants, half an acre of rich soil in a nursery, and an orchard. Provided all of that aligned, the biggest unknown remained people's tastes. Food, like fashion, tended to appear in trends. An item debuted either with a burst of popularity, like the hamburger in the 1870s, making steak portable and quick, or with a great flameout, like the 19th century delicacy of broiled eels. Even if food producers could preordain innovation, truly transformative popularity came from individual eaters. Early adopters would need to feel ownership, as though they were leading others into a more enlightened future. This inconvenient reality would be clear to Fairchild in the Andes with a crop called quinoa. It was, by any botanical measure, a crop of dramatic versatility. It began with the Incas on the shores of Lake Titicaca, and the Incas built their entire diet around it until the Spanish brought cereals like barley, wheat, and oats that all seemed better. Now, in 1898 Peru, quinoa struck many outsiders as more novel than practical. A Scotchman told me that he considered a porridge of quinoa better than the finest oatmeal, Fairchild wrote, before listing all of the reasons it would never work. Samples of quinoa had once circulated at the Department of Agriculture, but it had been quickly dismissed. It was crunchy and fine, and had a confusing glow. No one knew what part of the plant one should actually eat, its leaves, as with its botanical cousin, spinach, or its grain, which were its seeds, thus making quinoa a fruit. Microscopes and refractometers weren't yet advanced enough to measure a food's complete nutritional content, which would have revealed quinoa not as a grain, but as a protein, with the rare quality of having all 9 amino acids the human body can't produce on its own. That, and not a trace of gluten. Its global popularity today, especially among vegetarians, is based on that finding, which seemed to surprise Peruvian and Bolivian farmers more than anyone. In the years after 2005, when quinoa was granted the highest honor in agriculture, the title of superfood, the global price tripled. But Fairchild had been too early.
other than pointing out that the Andeans had put quinoa in cakes and beer, and that it might be tested in the South in the mountains of Colorado, all he could suggest to his Washington colleagues was that quinoa could be useful as a medicine to remedy catarrh, a great buildup of sinus mucus the world would come to know as the common cold. And so, quinoa remained local and indigenous for another 10 decades. During Fairchild's visit, Peru's global claim had been over potatoes, which sprouted between the Pacific and the ridge of the Andes with more genetic diversity than human beings. 7 millennia of potato evolution had yielded variety unimaginable in most serious parts of the world, where farming was a business, subject to rules and regimens. If 2 villages were isolated from each other, the potatoes each village produced turned out as different as snowflakes. Any visitor to the region would have found small potatoes and big ones, varieties with smooth skin and ones with deep eyes. Farmers had bred types that grew on mountains, on hillsides, and close to the sea. Some grew best under harsh sun, others demanded shade. To an agricultural explorer like Fairchild, potatoes were old news. The tubers had supposedly already made their way to Europe in 1586 in the satchel of the English circumnavigator Francis Drake. They became such an easy and reliable crop that by the 18th century, nearly a quarter of all people in Ireland, the Netherlands, and Belgium based their diet almost entirely on potatoes. British colonists brought potatoes back west to their new colony in North America, first to the Jamestown, Virginia settlement, and from there, the tuber spread across the continent. By 1899, almost an entire century had passed since Thomas Jefferson had served at the White House fried potato sticks sprinkled with salt, a lasting delicacy curiously named after the French, even though the Belgians are believed to have made them first. As a result, Fairchild's hunch may have been that potatoes, bland in flavor and agriculturally boring, wouldn't be surprising or useful to anyone back home. Red corn and yellow squash filled the seed sacks that Fairchild prepared for Washington. Both were uncommon varieties with few redeeming traits, but the colors were novelties, good for, if nothing else, attracting bemused onlookers in pavilions of agricultural fairs. They also had the benefit of being easy to trace. If Fairchild ever passed a field of red corn, as he did in the 1920s in the American South and West, he could know the seeds grew in the United States because of him. For now, the colors would delight his desk-based colleagues back in Washington, and that alone was reason enough to send them north. Fairchild's curiosity was overshadowed by Lathrop's unbearable discomfort. His symptoms of yellow fever had faded, but in their place rose a deep distaste for Peru. The place held bad omens and bad memories. All this time that Lathrop was depending on Fairchild to be the brains of their expedition, Lathrop in fact had botanical experience of his own. Just one episode, really, and of all the stories Lathrop repeated at length to anyone who would listen, this one he retold so frequently that Fairchild had memorized every detail. It wasn't only boastful, it was personal, indignant, almost rueful, as though the man endowed with stratospheric wealth had in some way been slighted by the universe. When Lathrop first visited the Andes, sometime in the 1880s, he had been struck by how his mountain guides carried heavy loads up steep hillsides without ever growing tired. Their muscles and diet seemed common, as did their environment. The only difference, he could tell, was a plant called coca that the men chewed as they climbed. Lathrop was intrigued by whatever miraculous component in the leaves made this possible. He sent several samples to the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco to be chemically tested. If the leaves hadn't been ignored, Lathrop might have been the man who introduced cocaine to the United States. Instead, Lathrop never heard back from the Academy, and no records showed the parcel had ever been received. Lathrop being Lathrop, he claimed omniscience anyway, retelling the tale with a self-satisfaction that he had known something brilliant from the start. But in fact, coca was well on its way to popularization already, thanks to a German chemist named Albert Niemann, who in his PhD dissertation described the way he isolated coca's potent properties, research that required ample sampling, and came to the conclusion that coca instigated a flow of saliva and leaves a peculiar numbness, followed by a sense of cold when applied to the tongue. The suffix cane was added for its anesthetic properties, as with procaine or novocaine, leaving unmentioned coca's effects as a powerful stimulant. This modesty for cocaine was short-lived. Within a decade, cocaine found allure as a sizable upgrade from other stimulating plant extracts, such as coffee or tea. The large pharmaceutical company, Parke Davis, sold cocaine in smokable, edible, and liquid forms, the last of which came with a needle for easy injection into a user's veins. Around the same time, a morphine-addicted pharmacist in Georgia developed a formula for a drink that was, in its earliest versions, 2.5% cocaine. The product had only one obvious name, in homage to the coca plant, Coca-Cola. The world benefited from this, and many people, their brains full of distracting dopamine, welcomed the amusement. But not Lathrop. All he saw was a missed chance for glory, as the patron saint of hyper-human efficiency. After the wild topography of the Andes, Chile offered a return to predictable climates and fertile soil. The land also brought a coincidence of geography, particularly to someone doing the work of American plant exploration. Chile was almost exactly as far south as the United States was north, its capital, Santiago, at the precise inverted latitude of Los Angeles, California, Lubbock, Texas, Atlanta, Georgia, and Charleston, South Carolina. No two regions on Earth can be climatically identical, but if there was anything Chile could contribute, it was that its time-tested crops were ready to grow in many regions in the United States. The only delay would be that they'd have to go through Washington first. So it would be curious for Fairchild to learn later that of all the crops that he sent from Santiago, few would ever grow in the United States. There was a mountain bamboo known as chusquia, toned with a blush that colored the stalks red. He carefully packed saplings of a low-growing tree with no common name, just its Latin name, Persea lingue, that seemed a promising candidate as a street tree along the avenues in New York or Washington. His favorite was an ornamental tree called Maiten, with lazy tentacles that succumbed so much to gravity that it appeared to be weeping. It never made it to Washington. The problem may have been more bureaucratic than botanical. With all the ornamental trees he sent, plus the new varieties of squash and watermelon, and even some collections of strange Chilean beans, there simply wasn't capacity for such abundance. Food exploration was new, and Fairchild knew that the experimental stations to which much of this material was entrusted were not in shape to receive it. But there was one sample that made it. History tends to favor successes, not the failures. The crop he was about to find would be mentioned in his obituary as a high achievement, perhaps the greatest of his life. As he bit into the oily green flesh, Fairchild couldn't have known he was holding in his hands the future crop of the American Southwest. But he had a hunch. It was a black-skinned fruit, a variety of alligator pear, or as the Aztecs called it, avocado, a derivative of their word for testicle. It grew in pairs and had an oblong, bulbous shape. The fruit had the consistency of butter and was a little stringy, but unlike the other avocados he had tasted farther north, in Jamaica and Venezuela, this one had remarkable consistency. Every fruit on the tree was the same size and ripened at the same pace, rare qualities for anything that grew in the consistent warmth of the subtropics. In Santiago, where a boat had deposited Fairchild and Lathrop, the avocado had an even greater quality. Fairchild listened intently as someone explained that the fruit could withstand a mild frost as low as 23 degrees Fahrenheit. Such a climatic range suggested a perfect crop for America. From central Mexico, the worldwide home of the first avocados, centuries of settlers had carried the fruit south to Chile. David Fairchild mused about taking it the other way, back north. "A valuable find for California," he wrote. "This is a black-fruited, hardy variety." Lathrop tagged along on the daytime expedition when Fairchild tasted that avocado. He agreed that a fruit so hardy, so versatile, would perfectly answer farmers' pleas for novel but undemanding crops, ones that almost grew themselves, provided the right conditions. Fairchild didn't know the chemical properties of the avocado's fatty flesh, or that 100 years in the future, it would, like quinoa, find esteem, owing to its combination of fat and vitamins. But he could tell that such a curious fruit, unlike any other, must have an equally curious evolutionary history. No earthly mammal could digest a seed as big as the avocados, and certainly not anything that roamed wild through South America. History could wait, as it often does. While a cart with a horse idled nearby, Fairchild bought every avocado he could, emptying his pockets of Chilean pesos. He hoped within the bins was piled sufficient diversity to sustain the crop in faraway soil. Most of the avocados were solid as a stone, but by the time they were packed into small boxes, some started to soften, a signal that they ripened off the tree rather than on. Only when nearly 1,000 avocados were packed was Fairchild confident that at least a few would survive the lengthy ocean voyage. On each box he wrote in large block letters, Washington, D.C., Department of Agriculture, Division of Seed and Plant Introduction. And he watched as the crates were carried away. On June 10, 1899, the day Orator F. Cook opened one of the boxes back in Washington, the first indication of Fairchild's eager endorsement of this particular shipment was its size. Cook was the man unlucky enough to replace Fairchild as the office-based recipient of hunted plants. More than 10 boxes sat in Cook's office. He pried one open, picked up an avocado, and bit into the rind, then peeled back its skin to inspect its flesh. The fruit was clearly rotten, emitting a putrid smell of brown mold, but the important part, the seed and its genetic material, was alive. Cook had seen an avocado before, but not like this. So smooth, so green. The fruit took an express route to the greenhouse, where workers propagated the seeds, first in soil, and then suspended slightly in water. Fairchild had included written instructions that only mature trees would fruit after several years, not months. He advised that as soon as the seedlings grew reasonable roots, they should be shipped to experiment stations in California to be shared with farmers interested in experimental crops. Cook complied, and then mostly forgot about the avocado. In California, that single shipment helped build an industry. Other avocados turned up as well, from travelers or tourists who packed the oversized seeds as souvenirs. There were one-off stories that avocados had been spotted in America before, in Hollywood in 1886, or near Miami in 1894. But none were as sturdy as Fairchild's Chilean variety, prized for its versatility, color, and flavor, a resume of strong pedigree. Fairchild's avocado would turn out to be a mix of a Guatemalan avocado and a Mexican avocado, and to have been only a short-term tenant in Chilean soil before Fairchild picked it up. But as with most popular fruits, the true geographic origin faded into irrelevance. Farmers and early geneticists dissected this sample and ones that came after it to create newer cultivars attuned to more specialized climates or tastes. This work yielded a 20th century variety called Fuerte, Spanish for strong, growable in the coldest conditions ever tested on an avocado. It fell from favor after proving unable to ship even modest distances without bruising. A different descendant of Fairchild's shipment of avocados would endure as the lasting variety. A quarter century after Fairchild tasted his first Chilean avocado, a mail carrier in Fallbrook, California, foresaw dollar signs in the fruit and managed to collect seeds from every available avocado, from fields, from neighbors, even from the trash bins of restaurant kitchens. He wasn't a botanist. He had dropped out of high school and had little academic training. He was simply an early enthusiast. The man kept a garden behind his house, and in 1926, when one of the seeds sprouted completely vertical, unlike other varieties, his kids were the first to notice. Within a few months, when the small tree formed walnut-sized nuggets of fruit, at a rate of maturation far faster than any other variety, the man knew he had something different. He knelt next to the small tree, 14 inches tall, and had his wife take a portrait, a pose later memorialized in a painting. A decade later, on the afternoon of August 27, 1935, a full 36 years after Fairchild collected the Chilean